All right, back to another week at it. I can't believe it. 2 weeks in a row. I didn't have to take a week off. And believe it or not, I don't have to sit here by myself today and give you a solo episode because I got a real another great guest today. I'll introduce you in a minute. My name's Taylor Jones. This is Tall Tales with Taylor Jones. See, I can't even get through my own title gimmick without stuttering. Tall Tales with Taylor Jones. Think about that. You stutter, you don't understand. And you're going to start a podcast where you talk for hours. What am I thinking? Whatever. We're going with it. We're working with what God give us here and making the best of it. I hope you guys are having a good week. I'm having a good week. The weather is completely beautiful in Nashville. If it's snowy or cold, wherever you are, I'm sorry. I don't know how you deal with that for this long. It gets really old really fast, that whole cold weather thing. But it's about 68 degrees and sunny here and clear skies, and people are outside walking their dog and having picnics and jumping rope and doing all kinds of things. That's just on the 10-minute drive here to the studio that I saw. So what's going on with me this week? Any updates? Nothing really, just getting ready for going on the road with Jenny and Tyler a little bit, trying to, me and Tyler are making sure that we're playing the same song at the same time, you know, once a week. And so I'm getting ready for that. It starts at the end of the month and goes into April a little bit. That's exciting for me because he's playing some cool venues. They're playing some cool venues, and it's going to be a challenge. I've never done that before, actually. I've never played with artists that weren't kin to me before. So we'll see how this goes. Not on multiple shows on the road basis. I've played with other artists, don't get me wrong, but not like for real, for real. So y'all, you know what I'm saying, be looking out for that. I'll announce some dates closer to time. So if you're in the area, you know, it's like Atlanta and here in Texas and Birmingham and Chattanooga, that whole thing. So anyway, so I learned a lesson the hard way yesterday, folks. And this is one of those things that my ego said yes when my brain said no, but my brain lost out on the argument. Like, I decided to go with ego instead of brain. But we've had a ton of rain up here the last couple weeks, and the grass is really starting to grow, and I've been putting off cutting my grass. I didn't want to do it. I cut my dad's grass. He lives next door to me. So grass cutting at our house is like 2.5-hour ordeal, and that's with a commercial grade mower. So I didn't want to do it. I was putting it off. I was denying the fact that it's spring and it's time to mow grass again. But I finally said, well, I got a day. I need to get up and do this. So I did it. Now, it'd been raining like crazy, so I was putting it off because I didn't want to get, you know, out there when the grass was all soft and get my mower stuck, which I've done 1,000 times and still somehow find ways to get stuck. So we got a big old long ditch at the end of our thing. The rest of the yard was nice and dry. Everything was cool. I waited till Wednesday. It hadn't rained since like Sunday or Monday maybe. And sure enough, I finished the whole yard and I got everything done but the ditch. And sometimes when it's really wet, I'll just leave the ditch as is and not worry about it. It's like a big old mustache on the front of your yard. It looks kind of cool. But this time I said, well, let me go ahead and do this ditch now because it'll look a lot better. And sure enough, I got about halfway through the second stripe through the ditch, and next thing I know, the wheels are spinning. The wheels are spinning, but the mower is no longer moving, people. And if you know anything about zero-turn lawnmowers, you know that as you go to pushing the arms backwards and forwards, you just dig deeper and deeper into the mud. And next thing I know, it looks like the Amazon, and I'm in a bunch of quicksand, and I'm stuck. And it's embarrassing because all of my neighborhood can see me stuck at the bottom of the hill. So just when you think you're smart, just when you think you're getting somewhere in life, you get your tractor stuck in the mud, and everybody can see it. So what did I do? I had to go back up to the top of the hill and get the truck and pull the tractor out of the mud. And it made a horrendous track of a black track where I had dug myself in so deep, and everything like that. It looks so stupid now. My dad laughed at me because he told me not to do it, and he was on the side of the brain, and I didn't listen to him either. So, sure enough, we got a big old long racing stripe going across our ditch now because of me. But this is what I learned. You got to keep a big old ratchet strap in your truck for in such emergencies. You can get your tractor up out of the ditch without nobody else's help. That's one thing I've learned cutting grass over the years. You got to be ready to pull yourself out of the ditch from time to time, because sometimes there just ain't nobody else there to help you, and you got to improvise. But you can do it. Great big old ratchet strap or a chain or something like that. And use your vehicle. You'll get it out. Just make sure the vehicle's on pavement. All right. So that's enough for that story. I think I kept this open right at 5 minutes again. And so I'm real excited. When I first started this podcast idea, I wrote out a list of about 20 or 25 names of guys that I would really love to interview and talk to. Guys that I've either been around or worked with before that I would think would be interesting for you all to learn from, as well as for me through this conversation today. One of the guys that was right there with the first top three people or so that I thought of is joining me on the podcast today. It's a big day for me. So my brother, producer, Mr. Paul Moak, is in the building. Well, I'm in his building.
Hey, hey.
I'm in your building. This is your building.
Yep.
So we're here at his Smokestack Studio in Nashville. And it's actually right down the street from my house, which is so awesome. And 10 minutes to get here. And it's the best vibing place in town, ain't it, Paul?
I don't know if you know this, but this room is where that band The Vespers cut their record.
Oh, yes. Well, we did. So let's go right to that then. So right in here, we met Paul on a writing session on this couch and around these chairs a couple years ago, me and Phoebe did. And it was like, basically, when you come in here, and I'll show you the picture. You guys have seen the pictures on the Instagram. You know how this place is. But you just, like, want to stay. I feel like a stray cat or a puppy or something. It's like the back porch and you just of some family, and you're like, I don't want to leave.
We love that, though, man. That's what it's all about.
Well, it definitely got our attention really quickly, and we were just, me and Phoebe, we walked out here, we go like, dude, I would love to like get to maybe record something here someday. And, well, make that a couple months later. And so that was awesome. We cut Sisters and Brothers in here. And I'm still very proud of that record and those songs and that experience that we got to have in here for what, a month or so off and on, was really one of the highlights of my life and highlights of our career for sure. So, but the man in charge of all that is here with me today. So
thanks for having me, man.
Dude, I'm honored that you're here, and just thankful, man. So dude, let me tell you what happened after. You are the reason why I went and bought a set of 60s Ludwigs.
Oh yeah.
after I left here.
Absolutely.
And I was like, okay, so because I had never really like got to spend any time on an older set.
Yeah.
Like, I, you know, here and there you'll play, like, whatever, house kit, and it'll be an old Ludwig, but it's got crappy heads on it. You don't really get to. But in here, getting to spend a couple weeks on, because Paul has this Champagne Sparkle Ludwig, 60-ish, 60-something.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, man, I got to get me one of those. And finally did, and I'm so thrilled with it. It's so different. I play Gretsch drums mostly, and they're so different.
Yeah.
And if you ever, I'm sure you know, it's a massive difference. But yeah, I think those two sounds, if you can have those two sides of the polar opposites or whatever you call that, that's a good place to start.
Absolutely, man.
Yeah.
This is more of a Gretsch town too, so I like having.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me about that.
I don't know if it's like country or what, but it just seems like there's a lot more drummers that favor Gretsch. It might, maybe Forks.
It's Gary, yeah. Gary's indoctrinated the whole town.
Exactly.
Yeah, because Gary likes Gretsch. And, dude,
man, for me, everything systematically goes back to the Beatles and, you know.
Well, think about that, okay? So, because I've talked about this with my drummer friends. That was the single most important endorsement drum endorsement of all time.
Absolutely.
There's not a single one that is bigger than Ringo on Ed Sullivan with Ludwig drums.
Yeah.
Because after
all,
that...
All the instruments that they were playing, but...
Yeah.
But actually, the story goes that they got so backordered because of that performance that that's when they started cheating on the, like, what woods they used. And so that's why you have to find a... was it pre-60... What is it, 63?
They would. That was 64 they did 64. That show. My set's a 64.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah. But you got to, like, you really do, because, and if you notice, they started mass producing them, so sometimes the wrap doesn't come around, and it's not sealed up by the lugs or whatever, and it breaks loose and all kinds of stuff like that. But that's drummer nerd stuff. But, like, going, because, like, John Bonham played Ludwig drums, and you can say, well, there's a big endorsement, but why did he play them?
Yeah.
Because Ringo played them.
Exactly.
So it's like, and what I read about that whole thing was, and Ringo's this kind of a guy, is that the reason he went, because he could have went any direction,
right,
like, of any drum company, but was because he just loved that Midnight Black, whatever that is, Midnight Pearl,
yeah,
that finish that was on that one, that now every drum company has one of those finishes,
right.
But at the time, so he literally just went, oh, I like that color the best, let's go with this one.
Yep.
Boom. Because all the guys in overseas were playing, like, premiere kits and stuff like that, and I think that's what he had before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know for sure, but Ringo's, he's such a cool cat. He was on something not too long ago, and he was, like, demonstrating some things on the kit, and he goes, and they go, well, Ringo, how do we play it this way? He goes, well, I'm left-handed, so I can't very well do this, and you go around right-handed, so I have to do it this way. And it was something else they asked me. He goes, well, I would have done more, but I can't really do more.
Yeah.
But it's just like everything you played was so perfect.
Yeah.
So were the Beatles a big thing for you as a young fella, Paul?
Absolutely. Yes. Fundamentally.
So,
my dad, he, you know, loves classic rock and roll, and you know, from birth, I think he has a little bit of the musician in him, but it never manifested in a way, you know, besides just a love of music, I guess. And, you know, he bought a guitar in college, that's actually right over there, and, that Vox 12 string. So he bought a guitar in college and learned a few chords, but it never really progressed past that. And so when I came along, I think when he noticed that music was something that I was passionate about from a young age, our connection, like the father-son bond, was definitely through him teaching me about the Beatles, the Stones, Allman Brothers, you know, just any kind of classic rock. And, yeah, it was kind of like from my dad, I was getting a heavy dose of classic rock. He had this barn that he's in the automobile business, and so they used to have a radio shop, you know, for aftermarket stereo stuff down at the dealership. And so he took one of those and mounted it in the barn, and it could only get a couple of stations, but one of them was the classic rock station, so we just had that on all the time. And then during the week, I watched MTV, you know, basically from the time I woke up to the time I went to bed, just because I loved music. And back then, all they were playing was videos, you know. And so I was getting, like, new rock and roll and hip-hop and all this stuff through the television. And then on Sundays, we'd go to church and sing these, you know, 200-year-old hymns, or, you know, Fanny Crosby and all that kind of stuff. So it was like a wide range of musical influences, I guess. But the Beatles were at the top of the list, you know.
Yeah, it's... I feel like we have a lot in common on that, because me and Bruno's dad was also just super, like, influential. His musical taste, like, his record collection to me is like everything, you know, whatever fundamental ABCs of music.
Yeah,
you know. So, and it's funny how the guys of that generation, like, universally, are like the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you just, it's just undeniable. I've never seen, I guess nobody has, a band that had that kind of an effect.
Well, it, like, just hasn't happened since then, because they were the first, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Beatles and Elvis and Chuck Berry. But, you know, I think the thing about the Beatles was, you know, Elvis in the beginning was a little bit more of like a pop star, you know. And so were the Beatles. But I think the fact that they played their instruments and they were really the first band to, like, the Ed Sullivan thing, like, to come into every household in America, and with a sound that, imagine if you had never heard that before, you know? We were talking about that the other day, because when George Martin died, we put on Revolver out here on the record player. And I think it was Within Without You. I can't remember which song it was, but something came on and we were like, could you imagine, like, people were hearing the, like, backwards guitar for the very first time in the history of mankind. Like, what would that be like for us now, you know? And I don't know the answer to that, but I think that's why that stuff was, like, why it's ingrained in people's memory. Like, you know, for me, like, when I was a kid, like, the Challenger exploding, you know, it's like everybody saw the same thing at the same time, and it was a moment that changed, like, a whole people group. And the Beatles, you know, on the Ed Sullivan was that, you know. It's like, where were you when OJ, the verdict came out?
Yeah, right, brother. Dude, I can, that's a real vague one. Like, I would have been in first grade or something, but I remember when that was just on the radio 24/7.
Yeah.
You're like, who is
okay,
OJ?
What about 9/11?
Yeah, of course. And what blows my mind about that is, going back to the Beatles, is what kind of upsets me about being as young and is I don't know what it feels like to hear that for the first time.
Right.
Like, I didn't get the opportunity to feel like, okay, if rock and roll as we knew it up until 1964 was, you know, the Eddie Cochran, the Elvis Presley sound, and then, you know, all of a sudden you get the Beatles.
Yeah.
And you're just like, whoa, like, where did those chords come from? Where did those melodies come from? That look, just the whole thing, like, because it's already programmed in my brain that the Beatles exist, when I go back and watch that video, I go, oh, that makes sense, because that's the Beatles. But
totally.
To them, you're like, whoa, what is this?
People fainting.
Yeah, and I remember I listened to a lot of drummers and listened to them talk, and it's like, if they're over a certain age, they go, well, when I saw Buddy Rich on Johnny Carson.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're a little younger, they go, well, when I saw Ringo on Ed Sullivan.
Yep.
So TV at that time being also really new,
yeah,
as far as, you know, like, okay, back 20 years ago, maybe the rich people had cell phones, but now everybody has a cell phone.
Right.
Then it was like, okay, sure, television came out in the 30s or 40s, but by the 60s, the early 60s,
everybody had one.
Yeah, and so now you mix in television with this new sound, and it's just like, there's only four channels or whatever.
Well, that's an important thing, too, is like, you know, technology and communications hadn't developed to the point where now we literally can't have another moment like that through television, because there, you know, there's 500 channels, and, you know, everybody was watching the Ed Sullivan show that night, you know. And we talk about that all the time here at the studio, like with music, there's so many different ways of receiving music now, and everybody has their personal taste on whether they like Spotify or Apple Music or Pandora or whatever. And then we got 500 channels on our TV, but we're also on our phone and our laptop at the same time. And it's like, people's attention spans, and, you know, I'm not talking about other people, like myself included. It's like, we've worked ourselves into this corner where we're not allowing the opportunity for something to affect us the way that people were naturally tuned to back then, you know? And I don't know if that's just where we are right now in the history of, you know, mankind or whatever, but it's frustrating as a music maker to feel like, you know, what if the next Kurt Cobain walked into here and we made a record, would it even be able to do what, you know, Nirvana did with Nevermind, with what the Beatles did just solely because of where we're at right now. You know, that's frustrating to me because it actually, the flip side of that coin is like Adele just did that. And that whole story is fascinating to me because it was like for a brief moment in time, she came and entered into everybody's household, you know? I hadn't seen that in a long time, actually, you know?
Well, and we, you know, one of my other buddies I just had on, Terrence, was talking about it. It's like, I think it can still happen. I just think it takes the perfect situation, yeah, the perfect package, you know? And I don't know, like Adele, it's, who would have thought, like, if she walked in the room, nobody would be, you know, like, okay. But when she starts singing, there's just some kind of connection.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know. I'm with you on this whole thing. Like, I'm just as confused as the next guy.
Yeah.
As far as the situation that the entire music and entertainment industry is in, you know. But at the same time, you go, well, if you just look at it from the perspective of a consumer, the consumers are... It ain't never been a better time for them.
Totally. And that's great because what you have now is people are deciding what music is great instead of, you know, a corporation or an A&R guy or whatever. And I kind of see both sides of the coin in that now we have access to everything and we can tailor our music to our own tastes and really kind of, as consumers, take more ownership of what our taste is and what we like. But what's missing, I feel like, that we had when I was growing up, where you were kind of being fed music through MTV and radio and The Tonight Show and stuff like that, is... you are exposed to things that maybe you wouldn't be predisposed to liking. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So it's like I always say, you know, I naturally loved Soundgarden. Okay. And so when I'm waiting for the Soundgarden video to come on MTV, I had to sit through a Tupac video and then sit through, Mary J. Blige or something like that. And it's like I'm passively being fed this information and in turn come to appreciate like styles of music that I'm not naturally bent towards, you know?
No, I totally understand what you're saying. So in other words, like you may not have went out of your way to hear Run DMC, but once you heard it, you're like, oh.
It's like, oh, this is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you just saw the cover, you'd be like, that's probably not for me.
Right. It's like, well, you know, when I went to the record store to buy a record or whatever, that's why they had those listening stations set up so you could like thumb through things to kind of test it out and see what you like. But you know, now I don't know, I didn't even know how people are finding music anymore. You know, I know a lot of bands that I work with use SoundCloud and they'll bounce off to other bands SoundCloud, but it's mostly new music and unsigned bands. So I don't know. Now I feel old.
Well, no. Well, we're younger today than we ever going
to
be. So
I never want to be that guy that's like, it used to be great and now it sucks, because no, it's not true.
No, it's not. It really isn't. It's just different. You know, it's different. It's not what it's not the same as it used to be. The rules are changing every day, and like, you know, like it's funny because as somebody who's been on the other side of it or whatever, it's been in a band and done this and that and tried to sell records, you kind of go, well, this whole Spotify thing is really keeping us from selling records.
Mm-hmm.
But from a consumer perspective, you got to go, well, as a consumer, I freaking kind of love Spotify,
mm-hmm,
because that is how I learned about new music, you know? And it's like, there'll be a Discover playlist or something and I'll hear that while I'm, let's say I turn the record on and I'm doing something in the house and something will jump off. It happens to me all the time like that. But only difference now is I got to wonder if any of these artists are making a living.
Right.
You know, and that's kind of, the only thing. It's like the great, it just goes to show you how creative people are going to create,
mm-hmm,
whether they make money at it or not. They just can't help it. We got to. It's just part of how you breathe, you know? And So,
well, and yeah, to that point, I think one of the dangers of where we're at right now is there are certain artists that should only focus on making art, but they're having to spread themselves apart. You know, like your brother Bruno is a great multitasker. He can play bass 1 minute and then work on a t-shirt idea and then, you know, then drive the van or whatever. But, you know, I think you're more the type of person that's like, I got to focus on playing the drums, and that's what I was born to do. And, you know, I think a lot of artists now are having to bear burdens that have to affect their creativity, you know. And I would like to see the system kind of work itself out to the point where artists are being compensated for their art again, and to the point where they can, if they're really great at it, that's all they have to be concerned with. Like, I would love to come in here and, man, just make records, write songs, do podcast interviews, and not have to worry about, you know, oh, when's the electric bill due? Okay, and I've got to update the insurance list, and you know, getting the mortgage redone with the bank and all that stuff that you have to do when you've got a building this size. And I'm not good at any of it, man. You know, but I can't pay anybody to do that with what I'm making.
I understand.
We got to do it in house, you know. So anyway.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean,
it used to be awesome, and now it sucks.
No, it sucks. I don't know why anybody listens to music anymore. We're helping. We're helping the situation, yeah, by saying it sucks. That's the thing. It's like, man, dude, I constantly go back to, man, am I making it better or am I making it worse?
Right.
You know, am I, what, in every situation, like when I walk in this building or whatever, I'm either going to make it better or I'm going to make it worse.
Right.
You know, like, you guys had a vibe before I got in here. And it was what it was. And either I'm going to improve upon it or I'm going to make it suck. Yeah. Like, one of the... So, I don't know. I just think, like, if we can walk around and just attempt to try to make every situation that we're into a little better.
Yeah.
You know, like, regardless of how pissed off, you know, you are at the way... at the challenges that come. Right. But they were challenges, I'm sure, you know. We never know we're in the good old days.
Right.
When we're in them.
Yeah.
That's always something that we say years later.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
and
a good point.
I didn't know. I think I'm like, God, 2009, that was the good old days or whatever. Yeah. You know what I mean? You look back and you go, things are different even then.
Yeah.
But
well, it, you know, what's funny too is like, I teach this class of audio students, once every couple of months from the Blackbird Academy, and they came over the other day, and, one of the guys was saying, like, basically every older guy that we've gone and visited with, you know, kind of says, like, it used to be awesome, now it sucks. And I was just sitting there thinking, like, in my life, it didn't used to be awesome, and now it sucks. Like, because I wasn't in the business when it was that way, you know. So for me, it's awesome right now. It's just different than the way I'd read about growing up and obviously everything's changed drastically on how people, you know, get their music, enjoy their music, how they pay or don't pay for it. But all that's kind of been happening in the same time that I've been trying to find myself, you know, as a music maker. And so I'm sitting here thinking, like, you know, the two records that I'm working on right now, I'm the most excited about the way that I was excited about the two records I was working on last year, you know? And so I guess what I'm coming to realize is it's all about perspective and, you know, what your personal definition of happiness and success is. You know, for me, I think I'm finding out that I think I'm in music equal parts for, solely for creating music, and then the relationships that come from that, you know, like my relationship with you and your band and the guys that work here and the other artists that have come in and out, like that's extremely important to me. And so am I making less than a producer would have that's doing what I'm doing would have made 15 years ago? Yeah, absolutely. But am I any less happy? Not really, you know, not unless you tell me that I should, you know, be unhappy because I'm not making, you know, it's like, it's all how you look at it, you know?
And what good would it do?
Yeah.
You know, if
they're going to change anything.
No, it really isn't. It's just going to cost you work because people ain't going to be able to be around a guy that's, you know, that crabby. But you bring up a lot of good points and, you know, what is success? I have no idea, but what I think, you know, as a guy who's still striving to like get to the point where to that, it's like if you're doing what you love for 40 hours a week
mm-hmm.
and your needs are being met, you know what I mean? Through mm-hmm. that, you know, you got a great wife, great kids, great mm-hmm. dog, like that kind of thing. You know, it's not raining in your living room. Like that's pretty cool.
Yeah, man.
You know, and like to get to come in here, you know, we're always looking ahead at like what our goals are.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times we're ahead more so than we think. There's another guy that's going, man, if I could just be where Moke is,
I'd be so happy.
You know?
Yeah. The 15-year-old me would like slap me in the face and be like, dude, this is what you dreamed of, you know, and you didn't even know it, you know? So I think part of, you know, coming to work every day is just kind of acknowledging that, man, this is a blessing. I don't know how long I'll be able to do it on this level. So I got to do it, go all the way as hard as I can now while I've got the opportunity, you know?
No, dude. So I just love that. So tell me this, because, like, I have a question, because mm-hmm. what I'm dealing with is, like, okay, I know that I'm in the position where, like, this is the time in your life where you got to put your time in, you got to earn your stripes, and you got to kind of, like, you know, you're going to have to spend some time and invest, and it's going to be a minute. Like,
yeah.
If you really want this, then start investing today, get better every day, and, like, you know, I'm a little ways off from being where I want to be, and I'm okay with it. But we're heading that direction. But what's it like when, okay, so like I walk in here and like you've got this amazing collection of gear and the stuff that people need to produce records and,
mm-hmm.
and to create music. And like, what was that journey like for you going from just a guy who was walking, you told me this, walking into pawn shops all across the country.
Yeah.
I guess you're on a bus or on the road with artists.
Yeah.
And so tell me about that transition from going from, a working musician on the road to a producer, well-known producer in Nashville.
Man, it's a, I'll try to do the abridged version.
Yeah, man. Any way you want to do it is fine.
But so when I moved up here, in 98, I had an acoustic guitar and an electric guitar. And, I had worked at a guitar store in Mississippi called Morrison Brothers Music. Let me back up. The whole reason I got into guitar is I won a guitar off the radio.
Oh, my gosh. How old were you?
14.
Okay.
Something like that. And they were, you know, the real Yellow Pages. So they were having a competition on the radio to show how fast the real Yellow Pages were, which is funny now. Because I don't even know if they exist anymore. But so they'd say, like, caller number 9, if you can find, you know, Taylor's mowing service in under 30 seconds, we'll give you a prize. And they said, tune in tomorrow. We're giving away an electric guitar package from Morrison Brothers Music. And so I was like, I'm winning that guitar, you know. And we had 2 phone lines in our house because it was the 90s. And
oh, we did too.
My sister, you know, talk so much. My dad was like, get that girl her own line. So I got on her line and my mom was down in the kitchen and I've got the radio next to me. I'm dialing, getting busy signals. And they said, we've got Gene Moke on the line. And I ran downstairs and she's flipping through the Yellow Pages and she found whatever it was. And won a guitar, and I now started working at that guitar store, because when they said electric guitar package, you know, you got to have an amp, and you got to have a pedal, and I didn't have any of that stuff, you know. So I started working there, and after hours, the guy Don Morrison, who's my boss, he'd be like, "Hey man, you want to jam?" And he's an older, you know, he was probably in his mid 30s, early 30s at the time, and I was just, you know, 15. And he would take down guitars off the wall that neither of us could afford, but it's like he would show me the difference between a Les Paul and a Telecaster, and what it was like to you know, the difference between tremolo and vibrato and all this stuff. And so it was like this deep well of knowledge just by having access to these instruments. And that's probably what started all this, is when I moved to town, I started, you know, man, it sure would be cool to have a Telecaster, to be able to have that sound, you know. And, man, it'd be great to have like a digital delay pedal and an analog delay pedal or whatever. So I just started collecting stuff, whatever I could afford, and I started touring in bands, and you know, that was pre eBay, and really you couldn't just go online and look up what something was worth. So if you're in the middle of nowhere and you go into a pawn shop and they got a cool old ratty guitar, you could, you know, talk them down and get a good price. And I was really good at just finding deals, and I didn't really know why at the time, other than guitar stuff, like this could be part of what I bring to a session or, you know, whatever. And probably in my mid-20s is when it was like, man, I'd love to have all this stuff set up. And recording had gotten to the point where people were starting to do stuff in their houses that was ending up on master recordings. You know, home recording had always been around, but not to the quality of where it was ending up, like with the early versions of Pro Tools and Digital Performer and that kind of stuff. So finally got a Mac and Digital Performer and an interface, and it started out, man, like I'd love to be able to cut some guitars, you know, on people's projects or whatever. And it just kind of grew out of control, man. It went from that to like, I would love to be able to do a good vocal, you know, acoustic vocal for whoever. And then, man, it'd be great if we could do drums, just one or two mics, you know. And here we are now. you know, people come in here that they haven't been here before, they'll be like, man, how did you get all this stuff? And it really is just 20 years of hearing a record and like, man, how did they get that kick drum sound? And then just kind of like immersing myself in it until I find out, okay, they did this, this, and this. Well, we can do that, but we're going to need this type of drum head or whatever. And just kind of, it's all about learning. It's continuing to learn about the love of recorded music, you know?
Well, I'll tell you, man, like, when we were in here with you, and it was just like, I don't know what my perspective of, because we had never worked. You're the first guy that we ever came to the studio and we're like, okay, we really don't have, like, we're really going to be leaning on this guy as a producer. Right. Like, we're not co-producing this at all. Like, this is, there's not like a lot in our pocket. We were ready for some help.
Right.
And so to us, like, we didn't know what that looked like. We had been, you know, like just an indie band for so long and just doing things that indie bands do, you know,
yeah.
Recording wherever. And, making, like you said, but thank God now, like, dude, you can have, like, I feel like I could do, if somebody knew what they were doing in a room, you could use my rehearsal studio and get,
yeah.
Nowadays the way stuff is,
yeah.
And get a quality stuff. But like, so thank God, because I think nowadays there are more bands that are able to get legit recordings out than ever.
Absolutely. It's a great time for recorded music, you know. You don't need this anymore. I never want it to be like a museum at all. This is a very usable working, you know, space. But I'll be the first to admit it's a luxury to be able to use all this stuff and to have it available. And that's just a piece of the puzzle that I feel like is what's important to me to offer to artists is, you know, your heroes made records this way, and I want bands to have the opportunity to do that, you know?
Well, for us, it was like, okay, we know for artistically and creatively, in order to take it to another level, like, we have to do something. Like, we need to get in a place like this. Like, it was our third record, you know? We were ready to, like, okay, let's invest in this area.
Yeah.
And we wanted that so bad. So for us to get to work with you and, like, really just kind of figure that dynamic out, I'm sure you noticed, like, when we first came in, how we were all super green about it. But by the halfway point, we were all kind of like, yeah, let's try this. And I hope that you felt 100% accepted into that process.
Oh, yeah, man.
You know, because that's exactly what we finally got to, you know. We can be kind of, I don't know, like, we can be one of the weirdest bands in the world with just, I don't know, the way that we come off sometimes and to people. And
well, there has to be an element of trust. And in order to establish that, you gotta take some risks. And I think you guys were willing to take the risks and in the end developed, you know, the trust. And really what it's about, man, is I still, like, the biggest platform that I preach about recorded music and what happens in the studio is there is still greatness in multiple people engaging together creatively. There's a greatness that happens that can't happen when you're making music by yourself. And so part of the reason of having this studio and the type of records that I want to make is really pushing people to lean on each other and to push each other, because I hear that on records. You know, you can hear the records where bands were being challenged to be a better version of themselves, you know. And, you know, I think part of every musician, there's a little bit of laziness, myself included, you know. And I think that's why, like, a lot of bands, after they're successful and they kind of lose a little bit of drive, they kind of plateau, and they get a bunch of yes people around them, you know. And but when you're in the studio with three or four, and you know, you experienced this when we worked on the record together. When you get a group of musicians in and they're all sweating it out and really trying to reach that higher plane, it's a beautiful thing when it happens, man. And it happens live all the time. Like, if you go see a band, you will watch one or two songs out of the set where it's like you kind of forget you're in the room and the hair on the back of your neck stands up and all that. And it's because it's people congregating together to experience music. And I still think that that's hugely valuable in the record process, and something that's a negative aspect of where we are. A lot of people work in their bedrooms, which is fine, but there ain't a whole lot of room for other people in your bedroom, you know.
I never thought about it like that.
So I don't know, I guess my little soapbox is that, you know, music was made to be, I mean, it's the universal language. It's been around since the beginning of time. And I just encourage people to invest in one another to make great art, you know?
So. Well, I tell you what, we all, the thing that we went away with from that whole experience that we spent here that for a couple months was just that the importance for authenticity,
mm-hmm.
in what you're singing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we had literally not, like, our brains had not matured, or our whatever approach had not matured to even, like, really think about it like that.
Mm-hmm.
But But like Callie tells a story all the time about whenever you took those lyrics away from her,
uh-huh.
and she had to sing it by remembering it in order to, you know, get to where you wanted her to go. And like, we all had moments like that.
Yeah.
Where it was like, okay, you might have played that one technically correct, but just wasn't the vibe. Like, right. It wasn't there. Like, little things like that. Like, like stuff that you can't write on paper, but you just kind of had to be in the room to go, was that the one or no? And, like, but the authenticity factor that comes from working in here and working with you and your guys is just, I don't know. I was so thankful for it because it's like, dude, this is what everybody sits down when they first learn how to play.
Yeah.
And that what they're striving for.
Yeah.
But whether you know it or not. Yeah. You just want to be, you know, real.
Yeah.
And the best version of yourself that you can. And so, I don't know. That's my biggest takeaway from the Smokestack is, like, don't come in here if you don't want to make, like, authentic music, authentic art, you know? Like,
I support that statement.
Yeah. You look, like, legit. Like, that's the way I feel about, like, when I come in here, it's, like, all those ideas of, well, we need to have a hit single or whatever, like, that exists in the world. But they really take second base to, like, well, first things first, it has to be authentic.
Yeah.
And so that's,
well, to me, the difference is you can have a hit, but are you going to have a hit that stays around? And all the best songs, even like pop songs and disco stuff from the 70s, like that you would think is, you know, authenticity would be thrown out the window or whatever. I still hear it in that, you know, if you put on Dancing Queen by ABBA, it's like, it's authentic, you know,
it still gets you to the feels.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I don't know. I just think that, that to me is the most important, because we can't control any of the other stuff. You can't control if a song's going to be a hit or not. I can't really control anything after it leaves the studio, you know? And so for me, it's kind of like, to relate it to life a little bit, the night before my kids were born, I was talking with my dad, and I was like, give me some advice. You know, I'm about to have two kids at the same time.
Oh, boy.
And he said, if you wait to influence your child and teach them what you want them to know, if you wait until the point where they are subjected to other authority besides yourself, then you've waited too long. So, like, basically, once they start going to school and get around other kids and, you know, other parents and other teachers and all of that, then they're going to be influenced by all those people. And so he was like, really, your job starts tomorrow. And I was like, whoa, that's heavy. But in the studio, it's like, I've only got a band from the time we meet to the time that record goes to mastering. And I can't control anything after that, you know? Mm-hmm. I can't control if, you know, the band breaks up before the record comes out, which has happened.
And, oh, boy.
Yeah. That was an awkward release party. you know, I can't control if the label makes decisions that I disagree with about what should be the single or how we should go about doing it and all that. And so for me, the time that we have in the studio is when we've got to make our mark. And the best way that I know to do that is to try to get the artist to be as honest as possible, you know?
Well, you definitely, you know, I can't tell people enough how much we were matured by the process of coming in here and coming out. And especially Callie, like, you know, you just had to know him before, mm-hmm. and she'll tell you, like, I guess we were just, as a band, we were really square and really kind of, you know, oh, just do it right. You know, do it as right as possible. Sing it as accurate as possible. But there wasn't really any desire for being, you know, just like bluesy and real, kind of like the real stuff that gets you in emotions, and all of it has a place. And I'm not knocking anything we ever did before, because I love our first record just as much as I love our third record.
I wish that you had written the song better now. Is that what it's called? For the record that we did, because I go back and listen to that, and I'm like, gosh, man, I wish I had recorded this.
Well,
it's a great recording of it too.
And that I loved making that. I loved the way we made each record stands on its own place to me. Like there's no comparisons, like with your kids, there's no comparison. They're all were perfect for what they were at the time. And we grew from each experience.
Yeah.
And everybody that was involved helped us and grew us. But man, we left like, I think Callie walked for real, like walked out here going like, all right. And she was way more comfortable with herself. Oh, like you helped her become more content and comfortable with who she was as a singer and as an entertainer, you know, because like I don't know that she had that mindset before of like considering herself an entertainer. But part of it is the authenticity and the bluesiness and the, like the jiving around and like, and that had a lot to do. I feel like we went through Paul Monk boot camp or something. And like, you know what I mean? Just kind of came out of it on the other side of it like an actual band that was starting to mature.
That's
finally
awesome, man.
When you start as teenagers, like there's a lot of room for that to happen anyway.
Yeah.
But
well yeah, and part of that is just growing as an individual. It might have happened in another scenario, but I'm thankful that it was, you know, in here.
Well, we were too, man. So this is another thing that like really if I want to ask you this before we get down to you know, the tail end here. But you really let's say you really helped us understand like a lot about balance while we were here as far as like personal life matters versus work matters, because we all know that like there's no rules and no regular hours or nothing.
Sure.
So we can, if we're not careful, we can legit spend 20 hours a day here and none at home. And then you get your balance, your home and stuff all out of whack. But you gave us some good advice about, hey, if I'm home at dinner time, my wife's happy, my family's happy, that's good for our whole family. The perspective, like I'd never heard anybody in the music business say that, especially in like music production.
Right.
You know, I might have heard it from, you know, like business office type that they get the luxury of going home at 5 o'clock every day. But like, there's going to be times where we don't. There's going to be times we start at midnight or whatever. But like, tell me a little bit about balancing, taking care of what's going on at your house, your wife and that relationship, and keeping that as a priority while at the same time working as hard as you do in here.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it amazes me that, you know, a lot of the people that do what I do, you know, they find a beautiful girl and then they marry her and then they spend all their time in the studio. You know, it ain't rocket science.
Come on, people.
No, to be real, I not just think, I believe that all of life feeds the art that you make, and the way to fill the well and get re-inspired is to spend time outside of what your artistic form is. And so for me, I'm just a family guy, and I love spending time with my family, and I feel like it actually makes me more creative and productive in the studio when I don't, you know, go 24 hours straight. You know, for me to go home, have some time not thinking about the record, when you come back in the next day, you got a fresh perspective. Things sound different. And it's just a healthier approach to life all around. Where it came from is when I was engaged, I was playing guitar on a record, and the producer, his name's Monroe Jones, and I had done several records with him just as a for hire musician, and I just really like coveted his family life, like his relationship with his wife. It just seemed like, man, they're so solid, and the way his daughters acted around him. And I was just like, man, I want what you have. Like, tell me what the secret is. And he's like, well, be home for dinner every night. And I was like, really? And he was like, here's what will happen. When you start hiring musicians and you get a, when you kind of become known as a guy that cuts off at 7 every night or whatever, he's like, other musicians will want to work with you because they know they got their nights off. It'll force everyone to be more productive during the day because they know we got to get all this done before 7. And it goes back to the musician laziness thing. Like, man, bands will come in here. Let's say we got a 10 o'clock start. They'll come in at 10:30 and then make coffee and wake up, you know, and it's 11:30 before we're even like tuning up an instrument. And then fast forward 3 weeks in the record, they're coming in at 10 and we're off and running by 10:15 because they're getting rest every night and because they're living life outside of the studio. Man, I haven't met one band. I've met a lot of bands that when we first start talking about how it's going to go in the studio, they kind of feel weird about it. I've not met one band that didn't get to the other side of the record and they weren't thankful for, you know, that approach. And it's not always like that. I mean, I've been here till 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, when you have to. But life's too short, man. I want, at some point I won't be doing this anymore. And I don't want it to be like when your kids go to college and you look over and you're like, who are you? And you know, we haven't talked in the last 18 years, you know. I don't want it to be like that with music either, where I walk out of here, I need an identity other than just being a guy that produces records, you know. So anyway, that's the long short of it.
Well, no, dude, Paul, thank you so much. You taught us a whole lot about just being a human being who just happens to, you know, whatever, make some music as part of their job and all this and that. And we really, really, really look back fondly at that time that we was in here. And it's more than just like, you notice we haven't talked about a single song in particular, really.
Yeah.
We're talking about the stuff that's sticking to the wall. And like that, these type of things are the stuff where I go like, because now it's like, well, I feel like I'm in a similar position that maybe you've been at one time in your life where you're like, okay, well, I kind of got to be ready to, you know what I'm saying, make it on my own and work hard and earn your stripes one at a time and just whatever, like mine one guitar at a time and one drum at a time and all that. But, you know, it's not all that though. It's a balancing act. It's like, man, I can look at home and go, dude, I'm a blessed man. Every day I get up and I look around and the house that I get to live in with Kyla and the dogs and the gear that I have and the opportunities to play, you know, like with other people, it's like, dude, even if it stopped right now, you know what I mean? It's already exceeded my expectations.
Mm-hmm.
This whole journey has already exceeded, I think in my group, a lot of our expectations, you know, and this place is a big part of that. And I'm so thankful to live 10 minutes down the road from it.
Yeah,
and,
man.
To get to see you around and Baja Burrito and on the regular.
Well, you know, all the bands that we work with, there's, you know, every third or fourth band, the life cycle of the relationship just goes beyond the making of the record. And you and Taylor have definitely been, you and Bruno have definitely been one of those bands, you know, that we just love knowing that you know, we're all kind of part of the same family. And it's so cool to, as this continues, for that circle to kind of widen. And I don't know, that's the stuff that, like, that makes me feel at the end of the day, like, you're doing good work is when you know that the time that you've invested in someone, is coming back through a relationship, you know.
Can't agree more. So tell me, like, what's the next two records? What are the two most recent records you're working on?
Right now I'm working with this girl named Caitlin Smith that's from Minneapolis. Incredible singer, incredible writer. She's had hits cut by Garth Brooks and Meghan Trainor and John Legend. But she's doing her own thing now, and her voice is insane. So we're wrapping that project up. A Nashville band called the Lonely Biscuits.
Oh yeah.
So we just finished that, and It's a great little three-piece rock pop record. Kind of stoner pop, I guess. And so those are the two things that we've kind of been buried in lately. And then I'm starting a record coming up with a band called The Deacons. They're from Cleveland, Tennessee. And kind of very Jimi Hendrix-inspired kind of psychedelic rock. So it's going to be interesting.
Well, I know that's right down your creek. So
yeah, man.
Yeah, dude, you can get in and get with them as much as anybody on that stuff too. So I love it too, man. It's just what we grew up on. And so where can, if a band wants to contact you, where could they do that at? Email or whatever?
Man, you can just go to the website, paulmokemusic.com, and let's make some music together, man. I'll say this. This is what I learned from you guys, because you were saying how much you learned from me or whatever. Man, there are so many bands that want to come in and take over the world, you know, and that's all good. Like, I want to take over the world with the music that I make too, but like, you guys came in and I don't even know if you realized it, but in the process of making a record, really showed me how you care for each other, and like, I don't know, the way that you would treat each other and communicate with each other. You know, a lot of bands come in and they play great together, but they don't really know how to communicate, and it can get kind of ugly. And especially you boys towards the girls, like, were so kind and gentle and kind of did a lot of the work that I usually have to do and that kind of stuff. And it just really showed me the character of who you guys are, and that stuff rubs off, man. I speak fondly of you guys to everyone that I come in contact with. So, thank you for inviting me to do this, and thanks for being my friend, dude.
Dude, absolutely, Paul. This has been an honor. Thank you for, again, just being an encourager and being a guy who, if you notice something that is a good thing, that you tell us, because a lot of times we don't know. I didn't know. We didn't think that we were exceptionally good at any of that. But when you tell us that, it's like, oh, well, that sounds like the right thing to do. Let's keep doing that.
Yeah.
You know, so thank you for all that. I'm sure there's a slew of other cats walking around this town that feel the exact same way that we do. And you got a big footprint here for the best way.
Oh,
so,
man.
Brother, this has been an honor and a bucket, you know, podcast thing that I wanted to do.
What's our time at?
102.
Perfect.
So you're right on it, right?
Yeah.
At 60. All right, brother. Well, for Paul Moak, I'm Taylor Jones. We'll see you guys down the road. Peace.